Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, where we weave together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, politics, and personal growth. The basis of the show, as you know, is that everyone has a story, and boy, do we have a good one for you today. The summer of 69 is certainly not the whole story for author Elliot Tiber, but from Stonewall to Woodstock, that iconic period is certainly a pivotal part of the author of Taking Woodstock and Palm Trees on the Hudson's Life, and we are delighted to welcome Elliot to the show. Elliot, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here.
And, you know, we have so much to talk about with your story, but first off, I have to say you're a hero to so many writers, because not only did you have a compelling story, or do you have a compelling story to tell, and the talent and discipline to tell it in such a riveting way, you also had the chutzpah to pitch the story to Oscar winner Ang Lee and get the director to put your story into a film. And we're talking, of course, about Taking Woodstock, the film that was based on your best-selling memoir. Tell us a little bit about how that all came about.
Well, my book came out in hardcover, 07, and they sent me to San Francisco to a TV talk show. And they had another guest, was Ang Lee. So we met in the green room. I knew who he was. And I told him how amazing talent he is, and I do his films, and I mentioned this and that. And I said to him, the only problem I have with your movies, he said, what? Seriously. And I said, well, everybody dies in the end. Wouldn't you like to do a comedy? He said, if I could find one, I've been looking for one for years. What are you doing here? And I showed him, wearing my Woodstock t-shirt. I said, you heard of Woodstock? He said, of course. I was in Taiwan. I was a teenager. We had long hair and bell bottoms, and the police came door to door with a wagon. If you didn't cut your hair and the bell bottoms, you went to jail. And a lot of friends did. And then suddenly Woodstock happened. Wow, it meant freedom for us. It changed everything in Taiwan and the world. So, not the Arab countries. The Arab countries, I saw them at a book show. They had a big booth where we had a booth, too. And I said to the guy, how come you don't have my book here in Arabic? So he looked at the English cover. A gay Jewish man and Woodstock and hippies? No. Get out.
They haven't caught up yet. Yeah.
So it's not in the Arab countries. Anyway, so I told Ang, I said, well, I'm the guy who did it and so forth, and I happen to have a copy of my book. I'm here with my new book, which is Taking Woodstock. It's all about how I did it, the festival. It's not a documentary. It's my life story up to that point, that 6 weeks. And so his assistant, his cousin is with him, and he gave it to him. He has a handler. I didn't have handlers. He had handlers. He had an entourage. At the time,
you know,
you
made it when you have an entourage, right?
The Times the other day said Ang Lee is worth $37 million. Wow. I had no idea. He lives in Westchester, a nice big house.
Yes.
Anyway, it's all unlisted. Nobody can find it. I couldn't find it. Anyway, so I gave him the book. I pitched it. I watched him, and then he was glistening, and the interviewer said, Mr. Lee, where you get the idea for your next movie, for example? So he looks at me and winks, and he says, I meet people all the time. You never know who you meet, like that.
There you go. Wow.
So, yeah,
and then he did it. He read the book,
Two months later, Universal Pictures called. I didn't know he was part of Universal Pictures. So Universal Pictures called and set up a big meeting with the suits in New York and all of this, and my lawyer with me, of course, and my publisher, and they outlined what they want to do with the movie, and I told them my requirements. And who am I to give him requirements? So you might as well say it, because that's how I always am. Open my mouth. You never know what.
So what were your requirements?
Requirements was he doesn't change the main character into a John Wayne riding a horse or chasing cars.
They did make him a little younger, though, didn't they, in the movie?
No, 34. The actor was 34 years old. And I was 34.
Was he? I thought he was in his 20s in the movie. Okay.
No. Anyway, if I knew him in his 20s, he wouldn't have been here for 34. Oops. Anyway.
Okay.
So,
So tell me, so how involved were you in the movie? Were you on the set a lot? Did you?
Well,
you know,
opening day, he doesn't allow us on the set. I didn't know that if you have a production credit, for example, executive producer, which is just a title, you're allowed on the set. That's why there's so many of them there. So I didn't know that. Anyway, no, he invited me opening day to get it all started. He had a ceremony from Taiwan that he did with candles and movements and stuff, and meet everybody, all the actors and that kind of thing. And then he, that was the morning, and the afternoon, it was into the evening, he was shooting. So I was able to watch the scenes being shot. And then the last day of shooting was a scene that they wrote for me to play, not myself, just a character my age now, in a leather bar sitting there with a slave on the floor and me whipping him. So they filmed it a whole day, 26 takes. And I'm thinking, are they really going to put this in the movie? Turned out they didn't because they didn't want
to. You were cut out of your own movie?
Yeah, they didn't want an X-rating.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Ang Lee, because of the film is everywhere in the world except the Arab countries. because of him, the paperback tie-in came out, and it sold over 57,000 copies. That's a lot of books. Most of my books sold 4,000 or 5,000 copies in the past. I've had some bestsellers in the past.
That's not small potatoes. That's great. Yeah.
Except, now, that was 2008. The checks cleared. It was a go. And then what happened in 2008? The world collapsed, and my money that was with Merrill Lynch disappeared overnight.
Well, you'll get it back for the next one, right?
Yeah, I hope. Well, I'm working now on the sequel, which is, it's a trilogy. This book's called After the Woodstock. It comes out, I think, at the end of May, and it's about my life right after leaving Woodstock and living in Hollywood and then in the village and then meeting my longtime companion, Andrea Nott, a Belgian director in New York, and I moved to Brussels and Paris and everything, all of that. And then following that, and then during the time of AIDS, we buried 40 friends.
So you do have. I was going to ask
81.
You. So you do. You will have the Tybor trilogy.
This is a trilogy. Yes.
Taking Woodstock and Palm Trees on the Hudson, which is actually the prequel, came out after Taking Woodstock, and then you're going to have what is the third one called?
After Woodstock.
After Woodstock. Okay, great.
After Woodstock.
All right, so you have quite a life to talk
tree
about.
The Palm Tree book is a prequel. What it is, it covers my childhood and growing up with monster parents and forced religious school to be a rabbi and then being molested by the rabbis. And then
talk a little bit more about, because I know you're pretty open about the fact.
They're all dead now. The lawyer said they're all dead, those people.
They're all dead now, so it's okay.
Years ago.
Yeah. No, go ahead. You're open about the fact that you were a gay kid growing up in Brooklyn in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional Jewish parents. You said your mom wanted you to be a rabbi. Is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I hated all that. I was studying art, and I wanted to be an artist. That's what I was studying in school. I was almost failing in almost everything but art and history and social studies, which I liked, and English literature. The rest, I made drawings for the instructor so I could get a C so I could graduate. I gave them sort of my drawings. Anyway, so I made my own way. You can't, and I tell, I travel across country and speak universities. I was so surprised, like the University of Delaware, I think there were 15,000 students there in the auditorium. And these are what, in the 1920s?
Mm-hmm.
And they knew the name Woodstock, and they wanted to know what it was. Some of them saw the documentary, and then some of them read my book already, and others didn't. And so on. We're talking about gay and lesbian and so forth. And I say, well, University of Delaware, I don't know, are there any Jewish dykes here? And four of them stood up and waved. It was so funny. Maybe your audience doesn't know the word dyke means lesbian.
Yeah. Well, I think most people, unfortunately, it's not a very kind way of putting it, but yes, that is. Well, you know, you're very open about obviously being gay, and I think
what's
when you're trying
kind?
To.
The word dyke?
Well, it's a slur. No. Well, it's a slur. I don't think.
No, I didn't mean it. I don't mean it as a slur. Some of my best friends are not Jews. They're dykes. I mean, lesbians. I'm not slamming them. Are you kidding?
I know you mean
they're
it.
Family.
Well, some people
they're
use it,
family.
Using the vernacular that way, but, you know, I don't know. I don't care for it. But I think the New York Times dubbed you a gay icon. not too long ago. And do you have some, do you think the younger gay generation is more complacent? They take things for granted, that things that you and other folks of your generation had to pave the way to.
Oh, yeah,
make
they
happen.
Don't,
I mean, look at,
they don't
look
know
at gay marriage laws now. Yeah.
When
yeah.
I just came out and in the village there, I just got into Brooklyn College and I was living in the village and the artists, of course, and there were only two bars. I couldn't get in. I was 16. But when I was 17, I lied. They didn't check. So I went in these two bars. And there were no dance bars or any of that the way they have now, major clubs and events and dancing, which is one I never thought I'd live to see such a thing. I never thought I'd live to see today Chicago has made same-sex marriage legal. So it's 11 states. I've never thought I'd live to see it. It's just amazing. I'm just worried about the scientists. They discovered something on Mars. They drilled a hole and they found water and people there, and they're talking to them and bring them back. It takes 700 light years to get there. And we're paying for that $95 billion.
You mean, is it worth it? You'd rather do more things on Earth. Is that what you're
saying? I'd rather. $95 billion, you could support all of Off-Broadway in every major city in the country and give films to young filmmakers and a couple of old ones, too.
Yeah.
And but, look, they're not asking me. They don't listen to me. I talk to them. I tell Wolf Blitzer off all the time on CNN because I don't agree what he's saying, but he doesn't listen. He doesn't call me. He doesn't nothing.
Well, we're happy you're talking to us here, Elliot, that's for sure. You're certainly a character, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. What were the things, I know when you were growing up, you said art was a big thing in your life, so the arts kept you going and kept you sane during a pretty tumultuous relationship with your parents, is that right?
Well, I ran away from home when I was 16. I said, I had enough of this. My father gave me $10, which was like 100 today, I suppose. It was a lot for him, he's a working man. Mother said, give me your key, I'm renting your room out, don't ever come back. But I had
now, was she joking or was she serious?
No. She never joked. The only thing that made her smile was at Woodstock, counting the cash, $187,500, which was like $1.8 million today, counting it in small bills from shopping bags and stuffing in her mattress, and she was giggling and smiling. You could see it in the movie.
Yeah, there's a very funny film. I was going to say the very funny scene in the film that shows that. So where'd you go? You did really run away. Where did you go?
I went to the village. I was living in Brooklyn with them. I moved to the village because I took a five-floor walk-up garret full of rats and roaches, which I never saw before in my life. And but I made friends there in the big gay community. My neighbor was Hawaiian gay, an entertainer, and so he showed me the ropes and took me around, all of that, and I started to exhibit at the outdoor art shows there in a small way, you know, $100 pictures, $200. That was good money those days for an unknown beginner. But as far as young writers go, across the country, university students, or any age, even older groups of people always, oh, I have such a story, my life would make such a book, and I say, write it. Don't tell me about it. You write it. Most people don't. They just keep saying that over and over for parentheses, if by magic they're going to have it. But if you want to, if you feel by writing a story or articles or whatever it is, or even newspaper journals, and you feel for it, then you just figure out how to do it. You can go online. There are free colleges now all over the country offering classes in writing and everything. And stick to it, and you find your voice. That will
absolutely. And
we live in an
era now with the internet and so many more opportunities for people to put their work out there. So you're very right. Just do it. That's what I always tell folks too. Just get in there, do it, and see what happens. And
you
certainly
can put
have.
You can put on YouTube, you know, whatever they allow, a 40-second clip of something with a 800 number or whatever.
This is the birthday of YouTube. YouTube was launched back in 2005, I believe, on this date. Mm-hmm. Happy birthday, YouTube, you know.
So you
had moved out already, but then at what point, how did your parents get to the Elmonico at White Lake Bethel in New York?
They had a house where, a hardware store in Brooklyn and everything, and they had taken us a year before up to a place called White Lake Bethel. We didn't know anything about it. We stayed in a rooming house, which my parents spent nothing, and there was a big sign for sale on an old house there, an eight-room house or something, and mother decided, that's what we're going to do. We're going to make a hotel here like Grossinger's. Grossinger's is the famed first hotel in the Catskill Mountains that burned down. Eddie Fisher burned down some years ago. And If you don't like the decor in your bedroom, you don't burn down the whole hotel, like 200 acres, and the golf course shed. You just say, thank you, no, I'm leaving. Anyway, no, that's not what happened. They hired him to do it, publicity stunt. So I was doing my artwork, and then I went to college. I went to Brooklyn College, where I had the fortune of, and I didn't know who they were, studying with Mark Rothko and Robert Motherwell and Ed Reinhardt, the masters of what became New York Expressionist School of Art. They were starting in those days. I mean, I used to share my lunch with Rothko and cigarettes with him and so on. And so I studied with them, and then I applied it to, I was painting murals now in apartments, and I applied what I studied with drawing and painting was these two masters. And one thing led to another. My parents sold their place, and they went up and they opened this dump, whatever, Sonia's Restin or something. I don't know what it was. Her name was Sonia. So I went up there, and then they were telling me, look, my sister was there and her husband. We want to buy this bungalow colony next door, and we want to build a motel. There were no motel. There was one, Howard Johnson's. There were little cottages. You remember? Well, you may not remember, but you could see old Clark Gable movies, cottages. So they built this thing, and I helped them. I run the weekends. I felt guilty. My parents, this is all they had, and I was making good money, but I put most of my money into the place, and we built this one building, two, three, four buildings, and so on. And
you were dedicated to them, even though you had a pretty tumultuous relationship. You were dedicated to helping them every summer, right?
Yes, in the summers. And then, unfortunately, by 69, all of our plans were going poof. The bank was going to take over the place. In June, we said, can't you wait at least for the season? Maybe we'll take in something. We never rented any rooms. We had three or four rooms rented. Yeah, we had no telephones, no air conditioning, no locks on the doors, no room numbers on the doors, things like that. And showers that did or did not have hot water. Depends. Not a place you would stay. Anyway, and then I heard on the local radio that the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair Festival, 25 miles away, was kaput because the town ripped up the permit. They said, we don't want it on the front page of the news. A farmer with a gun, a redneck. We don't want our main street filled with drug addicts, dirty hippies, dirty lesbians, and faggots. This was on the front page of their paper. So I called. Who are you? What are you? And I said, I have 72 rooms here. I said, well, 30 rooms. If you hang curtains between the beds, it's other rooms. So
ingenuity, right?
Keep up the promise not to move the curtain. Anyway, if they did, it was an extra charge. That was the point, $5 extra. Mother needed to make the money. So anyway, I called them and I told them what we have there. And I was president of the Chamber of Commerce for the 10-year period we were doing all this. Nobody else wanted to do it, and I tried to get something done, but there were only three members and who owned bungalow colonies, one of them three bungalows, and she always opened the big mouth. Well, she said, what we need is a monorail from New York here to, I think, to the bungalows. The black windows, people can't see. There are other places to get off. I said, a monorail. Everybody voted yes. I said, okay. So I never judged a monorail. This is the people I'm dealing with, Chamber of Commerce. So I said, I'm president of the Chamber, and I issued myself a music and art festival permit every year for 10 years. I'm on the Underwood typewriter. Probably for you people, you don't remember what typewriter is. It was a machine that did what the computers do, but don't.
We know what it is. We know what it is. It may be an ancient artifact, but we know what it is.
So they came with a helicopter. He said, you have sheets? I said, white sheets? I said, well, who told you they're dirty? This is a first class hotel, the El Monaco. So he said, make a cross on the lawn. So I made a cross, and the actors all knew what I was doing on the phone. They all got excited. They all stripped, I don't know why, and they painted their bodies with peace sign and love and music, dancing in a circle around where the helicopter's going to land. My mother's running around with blood to cover them up. They're 18 to 24 years old, these actors, you know, to cover them up and calling them names in Yiddish. And she says, oh, you're crossing my Jewish lawn. What will I do now? And she said, you were never any good. You're a terrible son. Anyway, the helicopter lands. They came out, and I met them at Lang, and he was a sight with wild Borneo hair. I never saw that. And a leather vest with fringe, anyway, a little Yorkie. So he came out there with the lawyer, and they saw everything, and the lawyer looked at the permit as illegal. He said, well, it certainly is kosher. See, Max Jasko was my milkman down the road. We bought butter and eggs from him, and he had a kosher stamp. So when I was making up these permits, I borrowed his stamp, and I stamped it kosher. So it was official looking. We couldn't afford a stamp. So he said, it's kosher. Anyway, so then within, and he said, where are your phones? I said, we have one pay phone. We can't afford phones. We have to pay for that. And he said, no, I need about 50 phones in here. So he uses that phone. He calls someone in New York, his big shot partners, Warner Brothers, which I didn't know. And within an hour, there are 10 phone trucks on the premises putting up pay phones. And he starts calling. And then an hour later, these big 18-wheeler trucks, these vans with equipment and everything, had no place to go. So they said, well, we'll pay you $500 for each one we can put on your grounds. But we'll ruin your lawn. And I said, lawn? What lawn? There's no lawn here. There's just straw. I don't know what there was. And mud. So they parked all those things and started making money. Oh, and Mike Lang, he said, listen, what about you? I said, well, how much you want for the permit? I said, $1. I'm so glad you're all here because the bank is going to take our place away. And he said, no, they won't. And I didn't know what he meant by that. So anyway, there we are with getting started, and then limos came and all kind of important people, and he said, I'll pay you $175 a day a room to rent. I said, but Howard Johnson just gets $8 and they have phones and air conditioning. He said, that's what I'll pay you, and I'll pay you $25,000 to be the Chamber of Commerce liaison with Woodstock so that everything goes smoothly. I said, okay. I mean, those days, if you made $8,000 or $9,000 a year, and I did, that was good money. That was good money.
So that was a big boon to you. That was like a few years worth of work just to.
It's 10 years, 20 years, whatever. So of course I was saying yes. And then he said, and there's another $25,000. He said, just to cover in case there's any damages. I didn't know what that would mean eventually, but anyway, because the whole place went to pop, and literally.
Right. But it was going to be wrecked anyway, so. Right.
Yeah, but they really went to pot. Anyway,
yes, you do have the famous scene in there too.
Yeah. So anyway, that's how the thing got started. So they looked at our land, which was 15 acres of slush and cesspool. They said, "No, this is no good." So I said, "My neighbor, Matt Jaska, is a farmer. He's got 100 acres there of open land, nothing but cows, and he loves them. Max came every year to see my little music festivals. He paid $1 a ticket every year. He was the only one. My mother stuck her head in the barn where we did this, and she says, schmutz, which is Yiddish filth.
So were you the one who talked Max into doing it, or was it Michael Lang?
Yes, of course. No, I brought them Michael Lang and Max. So he tells a different story. People remember things differently. Anyway, but no, I brought, he didn't know about White Lake or Max or any of that. Then he rented my whole place. I've even seen him say in print that he never heard of me and he didn't rent any rooms. He met Max by accident.
Oh, this is Michael. So Michael Lang has had a
he's saying that. He has his own stuff. Well, anyway, we sued and he had to withdraw all of that because it was all lies. Or a figment of his imagination. So anyway, so we moved the whole festival. They kept my place as the headquarters, as they said, until opening day, and then you could rent everything out again. Meanwhile, they rented everything, and we had a little bar, and they rented that, and the barn, and every little inch of space, and then hammocks in the trees. Somebody donated 100 hammocks, so people were sleeping that way in the pine trees. The only thing we had was pine trees. That was in our brochure. Surrounded by pine trees. No pool, nothing else.
Yeah,
anyway.
Pine trees, but you have palm trees on the Hudson as your prequel, because in that story you talk more about before you got to Woodstock, and other people, as we don't have that much more time left, just talk about other things in your life. I know Judy Garland was a big figure in your life. Talk about how you met her and why she was important to you.
In the palm tree book, I talk about that. I was decorating a nightclub, it turns out, for the Mafia, which I didn't know. I said, well, I don't know about that. Anyway, they rented the SS Peter Stuyvesant steamship ferry on New York Harbor there for 500 guests for an anniversary party, a wedding party. After 30 years, he's marrying the woman he has there with him. Okay. So she was very nice, very nice. And so they want to do this wedding. I said, fine, Ellie, you be in charge. You did such a beautiful job with this. And I knew them from Judge Mr. Schweitz, the Supreme Court judge. I did his home. He recommended his friend who owned this nightclub. I was a little innocent of that. Schweitz, later on, I lived in Paris. I saw in the Tribune. He was convicted of collaboration with the mafia. Woo-hoo. Anyway, so I got away easy from
you
all
bumped
that.
Up against some interesting characters, Elliot, obviously, right?
So I met Joseph. So entertainment boys, he says, listen, Judy Collins going to come. Wow, she was my favorite since Wizard of Oz when I was 10 years old. I had all her posters, her records over the years. And later on, I had an eight-room apartment. One was all Judy Garland photographs. It was wonderful and so on. And here I was going to meet her. So the party comes, and there's, when Judy comes late, of course, everybody leans over, and they thought the boat would sink. Captain kept saying, go back to the other side of the side. She comes on after blah, blah, blah. I introduce her. She sings, you know, Over the Rainbow, I think the Charlie song, whatever. I even had a sculpture done of her as Dorothy from Wizard of Oz and things like that. It was and all the boys were naked except the little gold pouches, and their bodies were painted gold. I had no trouble finding gay guys, muscle boys, who wanted to be at this party where Judy Garland was singing.
What was she like?
Oh, she was wonderful, friendly, and I'm very drunk, very stoned, and I had to hold her up, and we sat down in private and talked a while. But
she was very drunk, you said?
Very drunk, very stoned.
Oh, really? Well, that's kind of tragic.
Unfortunately, and she sang like an angel. Huh. Amazing she could do it.
Yeah.
So she had to sit down here and there. Anyway, so that was my time with Judy Garland, and her advice was, she says, listen, I was telling about my family, she wanted to know something. I told her, so she says, listen, you're gay, you make your own family, trust me, I know plenty of gays that are my family. So that was very nice of her, and that's what
very
I did.
Nice. And you have made your own family, and you've got so many stories to regale. I'm glad you're doing a third book coming out later this year, you think, is that right?
I'm sorry?
The next book you said is coming out later this year after Woodstock?
It should be May, I think, the end of May. Or something like that. They want to package it as a trilogy, you know.
Tiber trilogy, I love it. Do you think there'll be another movie? Are you pitching another movie?
I'm trying the palm trees now for a movie. I have it out with a couple of producers on both coasts. And the after Woodstock, I hope, will be a movie because that covers freedoms and Gay Pride Parade and Stonewall, all of this stuff it covers. And I think it's important for new people who don't know about it or may have just heard something to see what it was.
A very important part of history. Did you talk? How about Ang Lee? Would he be interested again?
I haven't spoken to him. It's too early. No, he did Life of Pi when I had the book of palm trees out when I sent him stuff. So I got acknowledgement. Thank you. We'll look at it. But he did like it. He has strange ideas. He doesn't like to work with the same people again.
Well, he has a very eclectic canon of work. I mean, Life of Pi, by the way, he's nominated for an Oscar.
Yes.
Maybe a long shot, although I hear there may be some backlash. The Steven Spielberg versus Ben Affleck, who you know got shut out of an Oscar nod in the director category. So some people say if people go against Spielberg, Ang Lee may win by default. So we'll see what happens there. But really, Ang Lee is a very versatile director if you look at his work. I mean, he did Taking Woodstock. He did, of course, he won the Oscar for Brokeback Mountain. He won
Lust of Caution. The Japanese,
Chinese. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. He did Ice Storm. So a pretty eclectic canon of work for
He is truly a genius.
He definitely is.
I know very few, maybe a handful in my life of geniuses. He is truly a genius. Like Mark Rothko was a genius. Very troubled. He committed suicide. So did Anne Reinhart. When I turn my back, look what people do behind my back.
They need you, Elliot. They need you. We certainly need you. You have such a great spirit and great stories to tell.
I lived in Thailand. When I left, there was a tsunami a week later.
Don't take it personally. I'm so happy you joined us. And listen, if folks want to find out more about you, as you said, you're all over the Google. If you can Google you, no problem. But you also have the
and
website.
And they can buy the books at Amazon.com or
Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Nobles, yeah.
They're available hardcover, paperback, and ebook. Are you on ebooks now?
Yes, ebooks are now up already.
And check out the takingwoodstock.com website as well. Elliot Tiber, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. You've been very kind.
Right. Thanks for coming by. You're on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Take care. Thank you. and we'll be back. Show here on Blog Talk Radio, and wasn't he great, Elliot Tiber, fabulous author of Taking Woodstock and Palm Trees on the Hudson, and a new book, the trilogy, will be out this May after Woodstock. Fascinating character, fascinating stories, and that movie, if you haven't seen it, it's worth a little DVD rental this weekend, Taking Woodstock, fabulous movie, Ang Lee, true genius, as Elliot Tiber mentioned. But wasn't he a great character? And one of the things he said that really impressed me, besides all the fabulous stories, was the idea that if you want to do something, you want to write about your life, you want to write about your experiences, you have to just do it. And that's what we're all about here on the show as well. Get in there and do it. And if you have creative gridlock, you took my journal challenge last week, right? Because a few folks did, and they got in touch with me. You can do the same. Hop over to the website, amybetharkawy.com. That's A-R-K-A-W-Y. Or hit me up on Twitter at AB Writes and let us know. Because I think the best way to get started is to just write. Without inhibition, just do it. Just do what you have to do. And a few folks wrote and said they did. They took the challenge. Remember, 30 minutes in the morning and or evening. Every day, just write, stream of consciousness, see what happens. And a couple of folks wrote in mixed bag. Somebody said, hey, you know, it's not for me. I tried it. It didn't work. Not interested. Okay. I think give yourself more than a couple of days, but fair enough. By the way, I will not talk about you or mention your name unless you give me permission to do so. And you can also call us at 347-857-4505 to tell us how you're doing and charting it. I did have a couple of folks who said they're trying it. They'll see how it goes. I had an ongoing email communication with Penelope who said I could talk about her. She was a little shy to come on, but she's open. The door is open at Penelope. She did say that she tried it, and it's working. She said on the fourth or fifth day, she started to come up with a character. And she is now working on a story. And she wrote, and she told me I could read this, she said, I have started a story based on this character that is the first story I have written in over 15 years. So kudos to you, Penelope. Keep up the good work. Please keep us posted how the story is going, how the journaling is going, and see if it works for you. And you try it, too, if you're having trouble getting your juices flowing. I think the journaling will help you. It's not a panacea, and it's not for everybody, but I think it can help. And by all means, let us know how it's working for you, if it's working for you, at 347-857-4505.
Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back after these brief words from our sponsors.
Chock full of nuts is that heavenly coffee. Heavenly coffee, heavenly coffee, chock full of nuts is that heavenly coffee, better coffee a millionaire, money can't buy.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love, grow apple trees and honey bees. No white
you know, Jackson, I think the funniest thing in radio is Alan's Alley.
Oh, you do, huh?
I think so, too.
Oh, you do, eh?
I think so, too.
Oh, you do, eh?
I think Mr. Benny is much funnier than Mr. Allen.
I think so, too.
Oh, you do, eh?
Arkowitz Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Happy to have you aboard. And if you want in on the mix, the number is 347-857-4505. Don't forget, it's important each week, each day and each week, to take steps towards your next goal. And don't forget that every step is important. There is no such thing as a small step. You'll do it. Keep working on it. Speaking of working on it, don't forget to join us actually, we're off next week, I believe. Impromptu shows will be added as necessary, but our next scheduled show is Friday, March 1st, our regular time at 1, when I'll be joined by Laura Lee Echebelli. She is a former colleague of mine at the Playwrights, the late lamented Schoolhouse Playwrights Workshop. She is a fantastic author, actor, director, and acting teacher, so she's got that Renaissance creative juggling act going, and she will talk about the juggling act, and also particularly how the trials and tribulations of getting an indie film made. She and her brother have been trying the last couple of years to get the true story of their grandmother put on the screen. And really, the creative process is not really, this creative journey is not for the faint of heart, particularly filmmaking, because it's such an expensive endeavor. And they will talk about some of their grassroots efforts using things like Kickstarter and other things to get this off the ground. So she'll be here. It's The Art of Perseverance with Laura Lee Echebelli. That's Friday, March 1st at 1 p.m. She is truly one of the most generous artists you'll encounter, so I'm very honored to have her come here. In fact, I was very honored to have her star in one of my short plays years ago. So we will talk all about her journey and this new film they're trying to get made. That's all coming your way on Friday, March 1st. And I'd love to hear from you. If you have a project and you're ready to share to the world, if you're an author, a filmmaker, a musician, a theater impresario perhaps, please go to my website and say hi. It's amybetharkawy.com, A-R-K-A-W-Y. You can also find me on Twitter at A.B. Rice. And just click on the contact icon. Tell me what your project's about. Tell me a little bit about yourself and your availability, and we will meet up. We will connect and hopefully get you a slot on the show. And likewise, folks who are having some trouble with their creativity and getting in touch with it and getting it moving, tell me how you're doing on the Journal Challenge, or if you need any other advice or help in that department, I certainly will be happy to reach out to you as well. So please feel free. As we keep saying, this is an interactive process. We're trying to grow a cadre of guests and folks who are not just guests but part of the show, have ownership in the show as an interactive forum for artists to help each other with inspiration and showcasing people, particularly those who are under the radar, who don't always get all the attention they deserve. So feel free to join us at amybetharkawy.com. So, great show. Thank you, Elliot Tiber, so much. Wasn't he fabulous? It was so much fun to have him here.
Since you've all been such good boys and girls, I would like to take everybody in this entire audience out for milk and cookies. There are buses outside. Everybody, follow me.
Milk and cookies, that sounds good, right? Just about now. Thanks so much for joining us. Hey, really, whatever you do, wherever you go, please drive safe, play nice, and dream big. We'll talk next time here on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show on Blog Talk Radio.